Perhaps you've heard the news story about plastic-eating worm, the mealworm, which is the larva form of the mealworm beetle. And if you haven't, the story goes like this. Researchers at Stanford University recently discovered that mealworms have quite the appetite for styrofoam, a plastic material that is commonly used, for example, for disposable coffee cups, cushioning material in packaging, and as insulation in buildings. Researchers Åsa Ståhl and Christina Lindström are exploring how the plastic-munching mealworms might influence how we in the future will live with plastics or without plastics. As part of the artistic research project Hybrid Matters, they encourage people to keep mealworms in their homes, watching them eat styrofoam and then use the droppings as soil fertilizer in their balcony herb gardens. Did I mention that mealworms are also edible? Baked or fried? Your choice. My name is Pille Brolman-Wengerfeldt. Welcome to Medea Vox, Åsa Ståhl and Christina Lindström.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Plastics. What got you interested in plastics to start with?
We were interested in hybrid matters, the kind of both things, materials and concerns that emerge in this contemporary era of ours, which is, I think, characterized by industrialization or sort of post-industrialization, where lots of things that humanity has put out there into the world in terms of design objects or what have you are now sort of accumulating and coming back in various ways. So one of them, actually what we started with, was to invite people to look for a new kind of stone or a new kind of geological entity which has plastics in it. And then not long after that, this research finding was published, which showed that common mealworms can biodegrade styrofoam.
Yeah, and when we started to see how it circulated on social media and other platforms, it brought a lot of hope with it. So basically thinking, okay, so now we can biodegrade plastic just with these common mealworms. Does that mean that different kinds of problems with plastic will just go away? Or this is a way of solving them? And we wanted to, rather than just talking about it, approaching it in a really easy way and mundane way and bringing it into our homes and inviting others to do that as well and see how it would be to live with this new finding and how it would maybe influence how we use plastics. But yeah.
Yeah, what I think is interesting with plastics is that it came with this modernist vision of how humanity could sort of rid itself from nature, not being dependent on the colonies anymore, where lots of the materials and resources were imported from to the empires. And instead, in the laboratories, this magic material, plastics, could be produced and basically turn out to be whatever format you wanted it to be. But yes, so then it comes back sort of, I don't know, with a vengeance.
And I think in the beginning it was very much used as to replace other so-called natural materials, whereas now it has turned out to be used for so many different things and a lot of the time also used for disposable products and packaging and so on. So it's often only used one time and then thrown away to become waste.
So plastics has definitely made lots of different ways of living possible and probably ways of living that weren't imagined by the first sort of inventors.
I have definitely been in a situation where I've found mealworms in my flour, being disgusted and having to clean through the whole cupboard because of how to get rid of that disgusting little beetle, really unpleasant to suddenly come across in your baking, for instance. However, that disgusting little beetle is also proving to be very fascinating to both you and many other people. So can you maybe talk about how you got to know them?
When we first read about it, we thought, okay, so let's try and see if we can get hold of this beetle. And it turned out that we could find them in common reptile stores because they're also fed to reptiles and birds and so on. So we went there and we got some worms and started to experiment with it at home. And I think that became some kind of negotiation of like, where would it feel okay to have it in your home? And
Yeah, most people know them as pests. So then how do you voluntarily bring a pest into your kitchen? That's kind of a big step for many people, including us. From what we understand, the researchers who did this discovery that the common mealworms can biodegrade styrofoam, that was also by just coincidence that he had seen plastics being eaten by common mealworms. And the thing is that we know other animals that can eat a styrofoam, such as cockroaches, which we also usually don't want to have in our kitchens, but they do not biodegrade it. So the thing with the common mealworm was that they can actually biodegrade the styrofoam.
So, but if we talk about common mealworm, it's basically I could go in a reptile shop and get some insects, and they would be exactly the ones. So it's no genetic mutations, so no bioengineering. You just, like, by accident, some mealworms got some styrofoam and started munching away on it.
Most probably they've been living with humans, so they've gotten used to human waste. They usually eat what humans eat, our food waste, for example. They're quite different from other worms that you would do composting with. So earthworms, for example, they stay the same, they don't transform, whereas the common mealworms, they would go, they have different stages in their lives. From what we understand, it's only when they are larvae that they actually can biodegrade the styrofoam, which also gives you a bit of a hassle if you bring it into your kitchen, because you might not want them to transform from larvae to a nymph to beetle.
What do you do with them? You just let them loose, or you just keep them in a jar and wait until they produce new eggs for new larvae?
Well, I think that was one of the issues that came up when we and others started to do this, because it was a 2-week experiment that we did, and we had to talk to each other and negotiate what to do with them afterwards. And that's also when it came up that these worms can be a potential food resource for humans. So then we started to speculate on whether we could maybe try and eat them as well.
When I was a child in Soviet Estonia, quite a lot of people were really, really poor, and there was a huge scarcity of resources. And then we had a humoresque sketch show which recommended people who are hungry, they should go and pick earthworms and have earthworms eat cottage cheese, because then the cottage cheese will fill up the earthworms and they could become edible sources. I don't think if anyone actually tried that, but I can vividly remember that kind of image of a earthworm eating itself full of cottage cheese in my 6-year-old creative mind. So I was trying to sort of thinking when we talked about the idea of mealworms being a meal, I kind of like imagined them being also stuffed with cottage cheese.
Yes, or having had styrofoam pass through their bodies. I mean, you speak about Soviet Estonia, and we live here and we think we live prosperous lives with lots of surplus. But taking the world in total, it's quite urgent already now to start thinking of and changing our practices of how we live. This is one way of thinking of insects as a protein source, is what lots of people do, and it's already a practice in many parts of the world, because it doesn't require lots of to grow them at the same time as they give a lot back to humanity in terms of proteins and fats.
Unfortunately, we as humanity, we don't think about our food as proteins and fats. We tend to imagine nice juicy steak, or we imagine the textures, the crunch, the flavor of it. So to have mealworms as a eating experience, I understand that has been part of the fascination of the whole research.
Yeah, I guess it's also a matter of if you know how to cook them or not. It's not necessarily easy to cook a good steak either. You have to practice and know how to do it. And I guess it's the same with the worms. They don't taste that much, so it's more of what you put them together with, I would say.
They have a really nice nutty smell to them. And of course, if you fry something in butter and garlic, then it will smell of butter and garlic. And that's, lots of people would recognize that smell. But I think it's got lots to do with imaginaries, like what do we imagine as good? What do we imagine as proper food, or what do we imagine as good practices? And that's also where, I mean, design research is not just studying the existing or what has already been, but also researching the not yet existing and sort of asking the what if questions. As design researchers, we can be part of imagining other kinds of futures or alternative futures.
So part of your design research is to learn to cook mealworms in a nice and tasty way.
Well, we collaborate with really good chefs, so then we get to know a bit more.
No, but that's one of the fascinations about your research, is exactly the venture out to the unknown, to go to these unexplored territories. And one thing is to imagine things yourself by just like sitting behind your desk or in your couch and just thinking, okay, what could the future be holding? I understand that this is not exactly how you work. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how the Hybrid Matters project has been outside the, I can't even say laboratory, outside the office maybe.
Yeah, so it's been these events that where we have done the composting and also the walks. And during those walks and the experiments with the composting, that has kind of sparked a lot of different imaginaries and worries and hopes and so on. And then we have tried to gather them and put them together into a speculative fiction where we both draw on what has actually happened during these events, but also the speculations that has occurred.
Because all the participants, they also come with their both experiences of participating, but also with their own speculations of, for example, we have an image here somewhere, I think it's over the, by you, Christina, where one of the participants put the composting jar into the kitchen cupboard next to the almonds and oats and beans and like really trying to imagine, what if this was one of my food sources? And I had it stored in my kitchen cupboard just like any other thing that he would eat. So that's something we hadn't done ourselves, but in his living with this prototype that we had distributed, he started moving it around. And yeah, his neighbors also got really interested, so they actually had half of the batch as well. And then, you know, that's how when we put something out there, it's not just our own experiences or our own what we can imagine, but also what the participants experience and imagine. And when they bring that back, we can work with that.
And so you go and make a story out of that.
Well, yeah. What the prototype sparks is scattered amongst several participants, for example, and in time and in location. So in a story, in a speculative fiction, we can sort of draw that together and add other things that we've both been hearing, thinking of, experiencing ourselves and reading. And a speculative fiction sort of has that space of possibilities that we can create, which is a mix of the previous empirical work that we've been doing with the participants and the prototypes.
I think it's only fair if we share some speculative fiction with our listeners. So do you mind reading some?
We've never read it aloud. It's written for reading, but we're actually trying to push ourselves to put it on stage. So maybe we should try.
The story that we have written is called Plastic Imaginaries, The Composter Meets the Rag Picker. So basically in this story, there are two emerging practices, rag picking and composting, and emerging practices of how to deal with or live with plastic waste when newly produced plastic has become scarce. These two characters, they live together and share a flat, and they have to somehow negotiate and live with these two suggestions of how to deal with the situation.
For how long are you going to do this rag picking?
As long as there is plastics washing ashore on the beaches. As long as we need plastics, as long as I have access to the beaches.
Can I have this piece of styrofoam?
What for?
I want to try something more transformative.
What do you mean?
Well, it's just an experiment. I don't know where it's going. But I've started to compost plastics. I found some common mealworms in our jar of oats, and I thought I'd embrace them in that jar instead of throwing them out.
Do you mean that they were already here?
Yes. From what I understand, they like to eat what we eat, but also what we throw away. And I wanted to truly challenge our dependency on plastics.
Yeah, that's radical. But okay, you go ahead and take that small piece. But do keep it small, please. And don't let the worms spread in the apartment.
It should be safe. I repurposed it, this jar that I found them in. I was inspired by the aesthetics of the kitchen practices of keeping things out. Now I use this jar to keep them in. Kind of funny. Look, ragpicker, small holes are starting to emerge in the miso soup cup you had a takeaway in the other week. You can even hear the sound of them chewing.
How long will it take until they're done with it? A week? A month? A year? And it smells.
Yes, I think I gave them too much cucumber yesterday. It became such a mess. I'm still trying to figure out how to care for them. It's too cold and rainy to have them outdoors in the yard. They seem to like it here in the kitchen. They always have.
Well, come to think of it, I'm less concerned about the smell. The rag always smells fishy and I've gotten used to that. I'd say that the CO2 emissions are more of an issue. Imagine if these grubs are working for us on a larger scale.
Yes. And imagine if the superworms escaped. We've made ourselves so dependent on plastic that I'm not sure we can cope with that kind of pest. Actually, I think the insulation in our house is in styrofoam.
I guess, as a rag picker, I'm mainly wondering if composting plastics would mean that we will get rid of plastics altogether. Why should we get rid of plastics when it has become such a scarce material? What kinds of lives can we live without plastics? Would we be able to live lives as we know them here if there was no plastics at all?
This piece of writing made me think of the scary superworms, but I understand that this is inspired by materials that you've collected and gathered of people living with these worms. So is the cucumber real?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we didn't really know how to care for the worms and neither did the participants, so everybody had to try different approaches and things. And we knew that they probably needed some kind of liquid, and we had provided with some carrots, but one participant, when he ran out of carrots, he chose to give them cucumber, and that turned out to be a smelly experience, and he even tried to wash them afterwards, but it did not turn out well, so I think they actually died in the end.
So when you're having mealworms as a pet, don't feed them cucumber.
Yeah, or as a compost. I mean, because that's also something that happened. I mean, with this prototype, in a way, we suggested that the worms would become a kind of labor force working for us, helping us with our waste. Whereas when people brought them into their homes in these jars, a lot of them also became quite attached to the worms, so not relating to them as a pest anymore, and started to care so much for them, so they stopped feeding them with plastics. Also, I mean, so it's a lot of different things happened when bringing them home in this way.
So are people experiencing the same challenges that if you have a bunny rabbit and you realize that's going to be a stew and then or a chicken and it's going to be in soup? So this kind of same attachments emerged around worms?
Yeah. Almost, yeah.
Mm. I think we're pretty detached from lots of the entanglements that we actually have. This kind of prototype can be that what sparks our both awareness but also imaginaries.
Did you have any children participating in the kind of experiments? Because I can imagine for them the whole pet discussion might emerge in a totally different level.
Yeah, there was one participant who actually brought them home and introduced them to his children as the long-wished-for pet. And of course, in the beginning, it was a bit of a disappointment. But it turned out to be that, yeah, his two kids got quite attached and played with them and used the
a torch.
Torch, and also played together with their neighbors, and then they had to divide them between his kids and the neighbors' kids.
Because I've been telling my kids that if ever we're going to get a pet, it's going to be stick insects. So I now have to reconsider it, that instead of stick insects, we might get mealworms.
Yeah, they are skilled in so many ways, those mealworms. they can both be a labor force as well as a pet. And at the same time, we can get really close to our own sort of food production, actually.
The food part of it, again, referring to my kids, which I happen to do this time often, is their whole idea of chocolate-covered worms or spicy crickets that we brought in from Asia. Do you see that in any time near future we would be having a production of mealworms as a food source?
I think so, yes. It's connected to judicial issues, what's allowed, what's not allowed. And just across the bridge here in Denmark, selling insects as a food source is perfectly fine. But now it seems like the rules are being harmonized a bit, or at least Sweden is sort of catching up with other European countries. But again, I think I guess it's this mixture of activists pushing the boundaries and the broader population also pushing its boundaries for what's possible, what's not possible, and then judicial issues being resolved. Because I guess for many good reasons, it hasn't been allowed to sell, but perhaps we need to renegotiate those.
Because it is, as we started at some point, that it is all in our heads. The whole idea of disgustedness or fascination of the worm or worm eating. I've been looking at a pan of garlic and butter-infused worms, and it actually looks like a Chinese takeaway. Noodles, just brownish, and probably smells really nice if fried with butter and garlic. But how can this kind of research that you're doing help the cause?
I think we're not really into solving problems. We're interested in hybrid matters, as in both the materialities and the issues, because I think whatever boundary we push, new issues will arise as well. Our research is very much about making space for issues to arise.
Yeah, but I think also that the different kinds of events, if it's the cooking event or composting event, becomes a way also to get familiar with other possibilities, if it's the composting plastic or if it's eating the worms. And then different people take that on in different directions. And we collaborated with Sinat Hassan on the cooking of the worms, and now she's taking that further by herself. So through engaging a lot of different people in our events, they can also travel beyond our own kind of engagements.
Because that was what I was thinking about, exactly this kind of providing individuals with these experiences and also providing them with a space to evaluate those experiences. You're also, to a certain extent, changing the world one person at a time. Do you know if any one of your participants has kept on the mealworms? Or
some have terminated the experiments or the composting, but others have kept them, and the worms have now become beetles. And I think it's a product designer who has also made actually a product for urban farming of common mealworms. So I don't know if that's what this participant who kept them will keep on doing, you know, breeding them to have a constant flow of both mealworms and beetles. What else has happened?
But I'm thinking also that it might not be so that they continue with composting plastics, that this experiment has changed their view on their consumption of plastics. Because the way it actually works now with the worms and so on, it's really slow, and it's not a very... And most people don't use that much styrofoam. That was also a finding during these events, that during the course of those 2 weeks, a lot of people didn't really encounter so much styrofoam. It has been, in a lot of cases, replaced with other materials by now. And I think that's also quite interesting to see how something like this can possibly, if composting plastic becomes a common practice, then maybe it becomes more okay to use plastics. So it can, to some extent, counter what it's trying to solve. So to give another example, in New York this summer, styrofoam was banned, but then that law had to be
withdrawn
because companies claimed that since it's possible to recycle styrofoam, you cannot ban it. So the technological development of, you know, being able to recycle it becomes an excuse to continue to use that material.
And that material is eating itself away to a certain extent. And we are using irreplaceable natural resources to produce styrofoam.
Exactly.
So it is made of oil, and we are getting rid of it, and therefore inventing different kinds of plastics, perhaps from other resources, or having to figure that out is something that still needs to be pushed.
Yeah, I mean, there are now entrepreneurs using mushrooms to replace styrofoam with, and that's great in many ways. But like what I said, with what we're also interested is in are the issues that arise with whatever is put out there. And with this new solution of mushrooms to use for, you know, cushioning different things when they're transported from one place in the world to another part of the globe, that just sustains the system of constantly demanding that things are available to us.
The research that you're engaging in is, to a certain extent, awareness raising, not only in the design community, but also awareness raising outside the design community, at least through those people who have participated. And their obviously neighbors are already aware of that kind of practices and all that fascination. Where do you think your Hybrid Matters project is going to take you?
It's taking us so many directions already. I guess it's about a continuous process of communication almost. So the speculative fiction is part of a show that's touring the Nordic countries at the moment. And yeah, we're now looking into mushrooms more closely, but also, yeah, I guess the paradoxes of entanglement. I mean, this is now on a more abstract level. We're all entangled with basically everything. At the same time, as we're recognizing the impossibility of solving issues alone, whatever kind of solution, new issues arise or new issues explode. So it's this, on the one hand, entanglements. We're all part of problems. We cannot solve it on our own, but we cannot either just withdraw. We cannot not try to solve it.
We're constantly part of the problem. We're constantly part of the solution, and we cannot step out. We cannot equate ourselves out saying, okay, I personally have nothing to do with plastics and therefore it's not my problem.
Yeah, there's no innocent position, I'm sorry.
So with that grim note, maybe we can finish and let everyone ponder about their innocence or guilt in the world of plastics and maybe look at their compostable or burnable plastic waste and think about what they can do with it. Thank you very much for participating, and it was lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
You too.